From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we look at how the 928 new Oscar voters might change the Academy Awards. And the director of the documentary, Three Identical Strangers and I, navigate the tricky waters of discussing how he made the film without giving away any spoilers.
On one hand, I'm a movie lover, and I love going to things, not knowing how they're going to pan out and being taken on a journey by the filmmaker. On the other hand, I need people to go and see it, you know, so it's this paradox that I'm wrestling with on a daily basis.
And two LA gallery exhibits bring street art indoors. All that coming right up. The membership of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has, for decades, been overwhelmingly white and male. Back in 2012, when I was covering the film business at the LA Times, a team of reporters and editors spent a year investigating the makeup of the Academy's membership, and we found that it was 77% male and 94% Caucasian. Add to that two straight years of all-white acting nominees in 2015 and 16, and the Academy was forced to make some changes. The Academy's president at the time, Cheryl Boone Isaacs, responded by announcing a goal of doubling the number of women and people of color in the Academy by 2020. The class of 928 individuals invited this week to join the ranks of Oscar voters is notably diverse, but it still leaves the Academy's membership with only 31% women and 16% people of color. Rebecca Keegan is a Hollywood correspondent for Vanity Fair. She's also my former colleague at the LA Times. And when we spoke earlier, I asked her if the Academy is on track to meet its diversity goal.
You know, when the Academy announced that goal in 2016, I was very skeptical of it because they announced the goal after the 2 years in a row of Oscars so white, 2 years in a row of all white acting nominees. And the goal seemed to me to be very ambitious given the size of classes that the Academy had invited previously. They used to invite, you know, 150 people, maybe 130 people. And I just could not fathom how they were going to so dramatically change the numbers with invitations going at that pace. Well, they didn't make their invitations go out at that pace. They ramped them up dramatically, as we saw with this largest class they've invited in history. Last year's class was the largest class they've invited in history. So they are certainly making really, really good progress toward those very ambitious goals that they set in 2016.
But as they invite more people, there is a legitimate argument, I think, about the people that they are inviting. And if you look closely at the list, there are a fair number of people who have what I will call a fairly tangential relationship to the movie business. The Academy says that its members are, and I'm quoting it now, the most accomplished men and women working in cinema. And if you look closely, you see among the new people who are invited, people like Harry Shearer and Hank Azaria, who are probably far better known for their work in television and on The Simpsons, or Audra McDonald, who is a really good actor, but really does Broadway musicals. So has there been some conversation around whether or not the Academy is changing its standards?
Interesting, because the Academy used to be much less transparent about its invitations. It was only about a decade ago that they started even releasing publicly the list of the people they're inviting. One thing you and I learned, John, when we were reporters at the LA Times, and we actually went through the process of trying to confirm all 5,800 Academy members, is that there are a lot of people who were invited in the 60s, 70s, and 80s who were not strictly people you think of as being traditionally in the film business. I remember Meatloaf being one person who made us scratch our heads at the time.
Eric Estrada from Chips.
Eric Estrada. There are a number of TV actors who were invited in the past. So I think there's no question that the Academy is changing the way it looks at people in who work primarily in other media, certainly in television. And the lines between TV and film are getting more and more fluid, which is an issue for the Academy as well. I do sometimes, when people say, oh, it was so hard to get in when I got in, and it's so easy now, I do sometimes scratch my head and say, well, it was different when you got in. Was it harder? Maybe in certain branches it was. Maybe for certain people it was. But I don't think you can make the case that this has always been the sort of pristine, elite, film-only institution and that suddenly they've just opened the gates to anybody.
Let's step back for a second and talk about what the bigger story is here. And that is that members of the Academy help decide who gets nominated for an Oscar and then who wins, but they can't really change what movies are made and which people get to make them. So if the Academy wants to honor more diverse films and filmmakers at the Oscars, aren't its hands more or less tied?
Yeah, I mean, this is the challenge for the Academy, and this is the issue that some Academy members have raised, which is that they're drawing from an industry where women and people of color are already underrepresented. So the films that they can nominate, the people who they can invite, by necessity are coming from this industry that's already upside down on this issue. The Academy has apparently decided to sort of take a leadership role in really pushing hard on the industry to change that. They've also done certain things, like they've launched a scholarship program. They've launched an internship program called Academy Gold, which is sort of geared toward getting people who are from underrepresented groups jobs in the industry, looking ahead to hopefully in, you know, 10, 15 years, those people have solid careers in the film industry and they then become Academy members.
And there's been a lot of speculation about how the changes in membership could change Oscar nominations and winners. And I've seen some people say it's going to favor blockbusters, it's mass appeal consensus now. And then other people say exactly the opposite, that younger, more diverse voters are going to favor art films and maybe more indie works. What's your take? How might it change the kinds of movies that are recognized with both nominations and ultimately with wins?
Well, the interesting thing is, along with inviting more women and people of color, the Academy is also inviting a lot more international members. There are a lot more people from all over the world who are going to be participating and voting, and that certainly changes the lens of what kind of movies people are attracted to and what they see. One thing I've heard from people whose job it is to get Academy members to see films is that new members tend to be very enthusiastic about going to the screenings and about voting. They're very engaged. So now you have 928 people just invited. It's almost exactly 10% of the Academy. The Academy's about 9,300 people now. One thing that tends to happen is after people have been Academy members for a few years, the sort of bloom is off the rose. They get busy with their lives and careers, and they don't see as much, and they don't engage as much. So which movies these people will like is an interesting question. I do think we'll see them really getting involved and seeing the movies.
Rebecca Keegan is a Hollywood correspondent for Vanity Fair. She is also the voice of On the Lot on KPCC's Take Two. Rebecca, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, John.
Coming up, a documentary tells the incredible story of triplets who were separated at birth and then, through random luck, reunited in their late teens. And that's just the beginning of their crazy story.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's series One Strange Rock, hosted by Will Smith and executive produced by Darren Aronofsky and Newtopia. An elite ensemble of astronauts tells the unexpected and unprecedented story of Earth, filmed across 900,000 plus miles, 45 countries, 6 continents, and outer space. Emmy eligible in all categories. Visit natgeotv.com/FYC for more information. Don't just consider. Explore.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. In case you haven't heard, KPCC has relaunched LAist with articles about food, culture, and politics. The website is once again your comprehensive guide to life in Southern California, but now it's powered by the KPCC newsroom. You could check it out at LAist.com. And now we're going to tread lightly to avoid spoilers as we talk about the new documentary, Three Identical Strangers. It's best if you know very little about the story when you go see the film, so we will try not to give anything important away. First, let's start with a clip from the beginning of the movie. It's 1980, and we see a reenactment of a kid named Bobby Shaffrin starting his first year at a small community college in upstate New York. When he arrives on campus for the very first time, people he has never met are hugging him, welcoming him back, and everyone's calling him Eddie. Here's Bobby and a former schoolmate remembering that day.
I finally made it to this dump of a dorm room. And before a minute had gone by, who now? Who now is going to come to find Eddie?
I had been to college the previous year with Eddie, and I knew that he wasn't coming back to school. As soon as this guy turned around, I was actually shaking. The color from my face dropped because I knew it was his double. He had the same grin, the same hair, the same expressions. It was his double.
Bobby Schaffrin and Eddie Gallen meet, and the story of these reunited twins hits the papers. Then, even stranger still, a third brother, David Kelman, sees the story and contacts them. These identical triplets who were separated at birth embark on an all-out media blitz, appearing on news programs and talk shows and in newspapers constantly in the early 1980s. But the movie Three Identical Strangers goes beyond that to reveal so much more. Again, avoiding spoilers, the film's director, Tim Wardle, and I recently talked about the movie, starting with how he got the siblings to trust him.
It took 3 to 4 years building a relationship with them. I mean, literally that long.
Before you were filming, just talking.
Before we were filming, I mean, we were obviously trying to raise finance at the same time, but it was a process. And even in the making of the film, it was... you know, some days I wouldn't know if they were going to show up. And it's, you know, when you see the full extent of the story and what happened to them, you understand why they would find it hard to trust people. But I also think when they became famous in the 1980s, they were promised a lot of things by people in the media who said they were going to do wonderful things with their story that never materialized. So I think there was a real cynicism from them. I think being an outsider, being a Brit, actually helped a little bit with that. Because they were sort of, who's this crazy guy coming over here and relentlessly pursuing us? But it was a real challenge earning their trust.
So what happens over the course of those 3 or 4 years? What are the conversations? What are the tactics? How do you make progress over such a long period of time?
I think it's just time with them. You know, you've got to spend time on the ground with people, with their families, and you've got to be really honest. You can't. I'm a real believer in not trying to sugarcoat things. You have to say, you know, there's going to be elements of this story. We're going to delve into things you'd probably rather we didn't talk about. But it's really important that you do that. And I think if you have that kind of, in the UK, we call it like the talk of doom that you have with contributors beforehand. You say, you know, well, I hope you're going to enjoy this process, but some parts of it you're going to find really tough. And some days you wish you hadn't signed up to do this. And I think if you're honest with people like that at the top, it hopefully earns trust.
There are some people in this story. I'm thinking of two of the brothers, Bobby and David, who are really natural storytellers. There's another aunt who is, in particular, I think, very insightful into the story about the triplets and family dynamics. When you're casting the people who are going to be in the film, what were you looking for? What did you need in the voices that you wanted represented from people who not only knew the triplets, but the triplets themselves?
Fundamentally, what you're looking for in a documentary is emotional honesty from your contributors. You get people who can tell a good story but aren't willing to go there emotionally. And documentaries are only as good as the subjects, the contributors. We were very lucky in this film that pretty much everyone we spoke to was a combination of good storytellers and emotionally open and honest with us, which, you know, you work very hard to get to that place. But I'm so glad you picked up the aunt in particular, Aunt Hedy. She is kind of the moral center of the film. And she is one of, without question, she is actually the most extraordinary person, single most extraordinary person I've ever interviewed in any context. She is kind of, being in her presence is like being in the presence of how I imagine being in the presence of the Dalai Lama would be. She is sort of serene and calm and has this insight. And she made 3 separate members of our crew cry just by off camera asking them about their lives in a sort of way a therapist would. She can kind of see straight through people. It's like empathy is this like superpower for her. And she is an extraordinary lady.
So from the very start of your film, we see a reenactment. When you are thinking about how you're going to tell this story, why were those important, and what were the rules that you and your team applied in using reenactments?
I think initially we were hoping that we could avoid any reenactments, but what we realized quite soon was that there were no pictures to cover those early moments in the story, and that those early moments were really important because they allowed you to take the audience through the story from the brothers' perspective and kind of get the audience fully on board with the brothers and aligned with their experience, so that when things went darker later in the film, you were kind of along for the ride with them and invested in them emotionally. In terms of the rules for filming those things, I mean, reconstruction is incredibly easy to do badly. Luckily, the company I work for, Raw, have done a lot in the past with documentaries like The Imposter. You know, our basic rules are don't show faces, don't try and make it into an acting performance and have dialogue. You know, keep it impressionistic, and keep the, I personally, my thing is keep the camera moving and feeling more documentary like. Don't try and stage it like a drama.
We're talking with Tim Wardle. He's the director of the documentary Three Identical Strangers. It is so tricky to talk about this movie. It's almost as if you have created this great meal and you have to tell everybody it's going to taste really good, but I can't even tell you what it's going to taste like. Is that odd for you as a filmmaker to be almost handcuffed and bound and gagged in what you can and cannot say?
It is the most frustrating thing. It is a paradox that when you start off on these things, you never assume they're going to be successful, and you know, it's great that it's going to be in theaters, but if I'd known how frustrating I was going to find it, not being able to, because I, you know, on one hand, I'm a movie lover and a documentary lover, and I love going to things not knowing how they're going to pan out and being taken on a journey by the filmmaker, and I want people to experience that when they come and see this film. On the other hand, I need people to go and see it, you know. So it's this paradox that I'm wrestling with on a daily basis.
Yeah, if you go in to see The Sixth Sense and you know that he's dead, it's not really that good a movie, is it?
Yeah, or Usual Suspects. You know who Kaiser Soze is. It's
exactly.
Kind of, yeah.
I think it's fair to say that the triplets would say the media exposure that they got when they were reunited wasn't completely good for them. And yet, here we have a film, and the triplets are now being talked about again, and some of them were able to join you in Park City when the film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. Knowing what you know and what they know about what fame and exposure meant to them when they were reunited, how are they wrestling with the fame that this film would bring back to them?
I think they're loving it, to be honest with you. I mean, I think I'm more cognizant of the risks and the downside of fame for them, and that exposure and what that can mean. I think they are just enjoying being back in that place that they were in the 1980s. And to be honest, you know, I think that they have just positive memories of that time. You know, they understand what the media wanted from them, and they understand what they wanted from the media, and it was a kind of pact that they had, and they acted similar, and the media loved that and loved that story and made them famous, and they were totally fine with that. I think the stuff that happened that was negative was to do with external factors.
So one of the things that everybody, particularly journalists and news personalities, are interested in is their obsession with how similar they are. The way they move, the way they dress, their tastes. That is almost the sole focus of their interest in these boys. Why was that the way that people normally gravitated to point out their similarities? What was that all about?
It's a really good question. I think there's something fundamental about the human fascination with twins and triplets that you know, historically there's countless examples of them from literature and from art. You know, we have been fascinated with them. I think it is something about that idea of seeing about genetics and the idea that, you know, two beings could have been made exactly the same. We want them to be the same. We want to believe they're the same. There's some need in us to believe that exists, the doppelganger, you know. And I think one of the journalists in the film, Howie Schneider, said to me, you know, the thing about being a journalist also is that truth is provisional. You only have what you have on a particular day. We didn't know how this story was going to unfold. We had what was in front of us, and that was great. And we presented that we didn't push too far to think about where it would go in the future. And he lectures in journalism now, and he actually uses this case as an example to teach his students what he calls the unknowability of narrative.
Tim Wardle is the director of Three Identical Strangers. Tim, I don't think we spoiled anything.
I don't think we did. You're probably the first person I've met who's been able to do that, so thank you for that.
We tried hard. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Three Identical Strangers is in theaters on June 29th. Coming up, some people may see graffiti only as a crime, but it's also an art form.
KPCC supporters include Center Theatre Group presenting The Humans, Stephen Karam's 2016 Tony Award winner for Best Play. Charles McNulty of the Los Angeles Times said, The Humans has come to L.A. at full strength. If there's a better ensemble working in America right now than the extraordinary cast of The Humans at the Amundsen Theater, I'm unaware of its existence. The Humans, featuring the original Broadway company, only at the Amundsen, now through July 29th. More information at AmundsenTheater.org.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Okay, the next time you're out for a drive or a walk in L.A., take a moment and look around. Do you see a colorful mural painted on a nearby building? Maybe some lively graffiti tagged on a billboard? Perhaps you spy some stenciling on a staircase. Street art is everywhere in our city, but we seldom know who made it and why. Now, two new Chinatown gallery shows invite you to take a closer look at these outsider artists by stepping inside their world. Frame contributor Marcos Najera has our story.
Steps away from Chinatown's train tracks, there are two exhibits this summer celebrating the style of the streets. One small, one big, but both pack a multi-sensory punch. At the Chinese American Museum, the show is called Don't Believe the Hype. The museum's newly appointed curator, Justin Hoover, worked with sociologist Ninochka McTaggart to create a sort of interactive collage for the eyes and ears.
So Don't Believe the Hype, LA Asian Americans in Hip Hop, it was about breaking this model minority stereotype. And it's the idea that more generally, stereotypes are stereotypes for a reason, because they're not really fully true. It's complicated. That's what I have to say about race. It's very complicated.
Dr. McTaggart says the exhibit explores what are generally known as the four pillars of hip-hop: rapping, DJing, breakdancing, and graffiti. 46-year-old Gajin Fujita had to discover his own connection between his street art roots and his Asian American heritage. For him, that epiphany happened once upon a time during a family trip to Japan.
We were in Kyoto, and I took a photo of, they say, Kinkakuji. It translates to the Golden Pavilion. And this pagoda is covered with gold leaf, and it just shimmers off the water. When I saw it, I was like, what if someone went there and tagged this pagoda? So instead, I said, I'll just make my own walls that are gilded gold leaf, and I'll do whatever the hell I want with them because they're mine.
Dr. Ninochka McTaggart, who co-curated the Don't Believe the Hype show, sees Fujita as a bridge between her show and the larger Beyond the Streets exhibit. In essence, she says Fujita is the perfect example of an American mixtape.
So his art specifically samples both like things that we see in America. So we might see like a boombox, we see a 40, we see tattoos, we see bandanas in his work. But then, like, speaking to his Japanese American identity, he also has like a samurai, or he'll have like one of his pieces had Fujin, the wind god, but instead of carrying a bag of wind, he was carrying a boombox on his shoulder.
Stepping outside the Don't Believe the Hype show, you can take a brisk 20-minute walk to Chinatown's northeast edge. That's where you'll come to a very large indoor warehouse. It's the temporary home of Beyond the Streets. The show is a sequel, in a way, to a graffiti retrospective created 7 years ago for the Museum of Contemporary Art by Beyond the Streets curator Roger Gassman. Despite the original show's extreme popularity, Gassman is quick to point out that it's still not easy to find a welcoming space for an often unwelcome art form.
Fortunately and unfortunately, so many museums run off of private funding and donors and/or city money. Most cities, or all cities, don't really like graffiti and street art, and we don't need to talk about why that is.
The why is a bit of a no-brainer. Most municipalities consider graffiti and street art to be blight at best. But more commonly, there are crimes that come with hefty fines.
Exactly, it's vandalism. I mean, graffiti and street art at its truest forms are vandalism. I've never denied that or tried to ignore that. It's real, and we've told the story of it.
And what's here at Beyond the Streets is a playground for people who love the sights and sounds of graffiti and street art. The spectrum of artists is dazzling, with an array of gender, race, and age represented in the works throughout the space. You might wander into Kenny Scharf's neon toy and trash room, or step outside to catch the replica of a tagged-up Venice skateboard park. By the time you pass the pole dancing area, the show's title starts to make a little sense. This is street art showing up in ways and places beyond what you expect. Or, as artist Shepard Fairey puts it,
you know, the aesthetics that inform my work come from a lot of different places. I grew up skateboarding and listening to punk rock, but I also love graffiti. So
Fairey is one of about 100 artists represented in the show. For most, Beyond the Streets showcases how their work is still deeply rooted in the streets, but at the same time has branched out and evolved. Back with Gajin Fujita at work at his Hillside home studio near downtown, he told me about growing up in East L.A.
I was kind of confined in Boyle Heights and never really left the block. You know, and I grew up with kids that never even saw the ocean. So that's why I think we titled it Extricate.
When he says we, he's referring to fellow street artist Alex Deffer-Kizu. They are the only artists who are featured in both exhibits. Fujita and Deffer grew up together and consider themselves brothers in many ways. Fujita says that while the Don't Believe the Hype exhibit at the Chinese American Museum is much smaller than Beyond the Streets, it's more personal to him because it's the first time he's created a piece with Deffer that explores their childhood. And no matter how far beyond the streets his successful studio practice might take him, Fujita says the OG spirit of the streets is never far.
Recently, I was out jogging around Silver Lake, and there was a piece of chalk on the sidewalks and stuff. And I picked it up, and I was tagging. And then I was looking over my shoulder.
But even now, though, I mean, you know, you have your own gallery space in Venice. Like, people know your work.
Yeah, but the popo don't know who I am. You know, and they could care less if I'm Picasso, you know? I'm always, like, looking out.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
And that will do it for today. Remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.